Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
This is 45 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and I got with me today Mr. Dave Teabag Martinos.
What?
You're expecting Dollar Doors Dave, but we've moved to
yeah,
Teabag.
Oh, yeah, that's because I'm drinking tea.
You're a tea drinker, old
yes.
Lady. Martino.
I'm drinking green tea like the samurai.
Oh, okay. Is that what it is? Samurai.
That's what it is.
You're a samurai.
It's my story. I'm sticking to it. Yes.
Yeah, please. Everyone knows what's really going on there. Screaming at the poor neighbor kids and everything. What a mean.
Get off my lawn.
Yeah, you're a terrible person.
Well,
anyway, so we are back in the house. We're getting close to that time of the year again. It's going to be fall here, and we've got people getting into, Halloween and Dracula and all that. And I noticed a lot of the, because we do our setups every week, and I noticed a lot of people going back and playing some of the old interviews we had. And there's in the top 10 recently was an interview we did with Chris McCauley and Dacre Stoker. That was from a few years ago. I noticed it boomed up another, 5,000 plus plays in the last couple of weeks. There's been a lot of the dark ones too, not that was dark, but you know, the subject matter. Yeah. You know, I've got to watch what I say here. But anyway, so now they've come back and they've got some new things to talk about, new items. So let's introduce or bring back Mr. Chris McCauley. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. And Dacre Stoker, thank you for being here.
Alan, thank you for having me back. Chris and I don't get together that much because he's in Edmonton. I'm in South Carolina, but because the power of modern communication, you guys have reunited us yet again on the air.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, actually. You know, could you imagine what Bram would have done, or what do you think his writing would have been like if he had the technology we had today?
Oh, man, it would have been a lot easier. I tell you, all the letters and the notes that I've read, his handwriting is terrible. He was such a techno geek. He would have had, you know, a smartphone. He would have had some kind of recording device for his notes, for his thoughts. But you know what? It wouldn't have been as much fun, because for what Chris and I have been digging into and extracting to create our Stokerverse, half the fun is the search. Half the fun is deciphering the notes, the TypeScript, all that stuff, and bringing his ideas back to life after 127 years.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. It's amazing that we, that you guys have as much information and access to all this stuff, and it must be thrilling going through so much of the of his notes or his handwritings and stuff. That must be pretty exciting.
It is, and you know, they are spread around the world, literally. You know, the notes are in Philadelphia, the typescript is in Seattle, Washington. There are letters in university collections in Texas and in Ireland, in England. There's a castle in Scotland that he was in, Transylvania. So it is a real Indiana Jones venture that I get on to find these things. And then they pop up as well on auction sites, letters of private collection. And when I get a letter and I find some new information, it's like, oh, yeah, another piece of the puzzle. I got one just the other day, guys, the Royal Literary Fund. And that's a fund that people would apply for financial assistance when they're having hard times. And Bram Stoker did. I'd always heard that when he was ill, near the end of his life in 1911, he died in 1912, he was having a rough time. He had no more job at the Lyceum Theater. Irving had died. And he had to apply for a grant. They actually had the letter that he wrote to them asking for that grant, which was pretty humbling, but also it revealed his illness at the time, so some real factual information. And it really helped me get an idea of what his headspace was like when he was writing The Lair of the White Worm, which is the last book that he wrote, which is a fairly strange book, and it made sense when I knew how ill he was that was the condition he was in. But those are the little bits and pieces that I find. And then I convey that to Chris. Chris, how can we use this? Which of our products? And, he's got comics in the works that we do. He's got video games, all these things. And we managed to insert some of those little bits of information just to make the story seem more authentic and more real.
Pretty amazing, actually. And before we get into the new comic and that, let's talk about, have you ever come across a note or some sort of item that Bram had written that sort of surprised you, or maybe even you thought, no, that can't be. It's just not what I expect.
Well, another one, but actually it had such an impact on me that I had to buy it for more money than my wife wanted me to spend on it.
won't say how much.
No, we won't. But it's, one of these things that comes up, you get a couple of weeks notice. It's an auction on a website. You don't really know where the item came from. Yet again, it was another letter, but it was a letter that Bram wrote from the Kilmarnock Arms Hotel in Cruden Bay, Scotland. And it was right after Henry Irving had died. So it was a very emotional time for him. Lost his best friend, but most importantly, he'd lost his source of income. He had no pension. He had no inheritance from Irving. He had no money. And he was having to offer himself up to an American opera singer, David Bisham, who was bringing an opera and needed a manager for a few months. And it was very sad for me to read that Bram was saying, I need this job back in my day with Irving, and I paid this much, this is what I did, I really appreciate this. I wouldn't say he was begging, but it was obvious that he was putting himself out there, and I could certainly read between the lines, and it really brought tears to my eyes when I saw it and said, I've got to buy this. It was gold, and because it encapsulated where he was at that time. He was up there on one of his writing retreats. That's where he wrote Dracula and other books as well, in Cruden Bay, Scotland, north of Aberdeen. But it also put into perspective what the man was thinking at the time. Again, when Chris and I characterize Bram Stoker at different phases of his life, that bit of information, a letter telling all that, is absolutely essential for us to get it right. And that was a bit of a shocker to find out in his own hand what he was feeling rather than what a biographer who might write about.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And make speculation, which drives me crazy. I'm getting this firsthand from the source.
Yeah, and there's nothing like that, right? That gives you the real feeling, the real what the person was thinking and going through, and I think that's the key element to anything when you're doing any sort of memoir or biography, right? So,
yep.
Well, Chris, now we bring this into you because now you are the circus master, the ringmaster.
Yeah.
So what exactly are you working on now? I know this is like a part of the comic sequel that takes place after the original novel. So explain for people that don't know about the first one and what's going on now.
Yeah, the first Dracula comic, so the full title is Dracula the Return, Cult of the White Worm. So we're bringing two of Bram Stoker's most famous characters together. And it's kind of, you think of the novel, the first comic's a bit like the prologue of the novel. So Decker and I brought the central character of Dracula back in an authentic manner. And we looked through some of the stuff that Bram had in the original novel that had been taken out. And there were these ape men-like creatures. And we introduced those into the mix. So those are kind of some of the unique elements which Decker and I bring that are crucial, really, to Bram's original vision. So we resurrect Dracula. We also have some great side strips in the first issue. One shows the fourth weird sister, or fourth bride, if you want to go down the route of the cinematic Dracula stories, because Bram actually had a fourth weird sister in there as well. And she's in London now, and she's doing something. So there's a little side strip there. And there's a little side strip of Renfield's first asylum. So the perfect asylum may not have been the first asylum that Renfield was introduced to. So we have those little side strips in there as well in issue one. So issue one's really the setup. And issue two is where the central plot starts to develop. So this sort of shows what Dracula's up to, parts of his revenge with the original band of heroes, you know, how the White Worm is helping Dracula. Who is this sort of, there's a lady in white, this fourth bride, who's roaming Highgate, and what she's really doing with the children. And then the really special part of this, for me, or one of the special parts, is that we're introducing Carmilla into the mix. So Carmilla, as many people know, is an older vampire story that was set before Dracula. It was another Irish writer called Sheridan Fanny, and he created this character, and we believe it's the first sort of LGBT vampire character in modern Western literature. So we have now introduced her into the mix as well. So that's kind of an overview of the sort of the first two issues and what's in there.
Wow. Well, this question, again, is for Chris, but Dagger could also answer this too. Just listening to you and talk about all these characters, and it just makes me think, you know, how do you keep track of all the research and the characters and the continuity and make it align with Bram's writings? Do you have tools or systems or some way that you do that?
Oh dear, I kind of feel like I have to lie here, but I'm not going to.
Spin a yarn, Chris, spin a yarn. Make him sound like we know what we're doing.
I have four white clean boards that sit to the left of me. And one of them is where, if I'm doing a plot out a novel, an audio or whatever, I'll scribble furiously in there. But really, the stories and what I'm doing kind of live within me. It's hard to explain this, and I was writing a Doctor Who novel with Terry Molloy, who's Davros in the TV show. We're writing the Davros Diaries. And Terry would ring me up and put on his Davros voice. And then I would talk to him. You know, I would read out the dialogue. And he would stop very quietly and say, he would be like, "God, that's Davros. You're just reading out exactly what Davros would say." So it's weird. The characters kind of live with you when you write them. And they stay with you. And I mean, I write lots of like different video games for like Sony and do different things, and even music videos for Sony and stuff. And the characters stay with you. They really live with you. So whenever it comes to picking up a thread from the Strokeverse again, that's what happens. I kind of just tap into that and it sort of comes through. But then, you know, Decker and I have an agreed continuity. We have an agreed, we know what the characters sound like. We know what they look like. You know, so it's quite easy to sort of to do that almost in your head, because it's so ingrained now. It's so much a part, I think, of the two of us now that it's there.
And we use Bram's Dracula as sort of, you know, the Bible. That's how it starts. And
right.
And I happen to have a couple of versions on my computer that I've done annotations with, different versions that I've published that have different things added in. And whenever I say, "Chris, okay, let's go back and use Bram's Van Helsing," I'll go back to one of these Word files and make sure I pull out exactly the words, exactly the things, how Bram described him, and that goes on a page, which then I talk to Chris, it goes onto his whiteboard, and that's the Van Helsing where Bram wanted him, Bram created him, and how we'll use him. Now, we will sometimes alter those a little bit, not too much. But we'll make some subtle changes, but we both agree we always start with the basic characters that Bram has introduced, and we may make minor modifications. Not a lot, but enough to modernize them a little bit and make them interesting. But, you know, you start with the Bible, you can't go wrong.
Does that ever bother you, or I guess when other people take liberties with Bram's work, like Dracula, there's so many versions of Helsing and Dracula and stuff like that, and variations across the board over the years. Do any of them ever kind of sidetrack you, kind of go, oh, that's terrible, or I wish they didn't do that? I mean, you don't even have to give names. I mean, of course we'd like them, but no. No, but I mean more in a general sense of when people sort of really kind of change the theme of the original idea.
Well, you know, you touched on a nerve, Alan, but again, Chris and I are tactful guys. It's art, it's interpretation, it's reimagination. And for at least me, and I know we chatted about a lot, I just say, look, it's a bit of an homage. You know, you copy somebody, you take his character, and you go off in a different direction. It's like, wow, that's quite interesting. That's different. I really like that, or that's not really for me, but it still adds to the mystique of things that Bram created back in 1897. And I know where they came from. I know how they originated. And boy, they're going off in a very different direction. But as long as people keep buying the books or the comics or watching those movies or the streaming, it's like that stays alive. And my taste is not the same as everybody else's, so I let it go. Again, it may not be my taste in particular about a depiction of any of the characters, or the one that is most changed is the Dracula. But as long as, you know, as long as it is still popular, as long as it is still getting, you know, putting people to go into theaters or watch it on Netflix or other streaming, that's okay. Because I've matured. At the beginning, it bugged me. But I've matured to the point where saying, well, Chris and I do a little alteration ourselves. Why can't other folks? Chris, how do you feel about that?
I'm not quite as tactful. I feel particularly aggrieved whenever I watch something that's terrible. I don't mind the changes if it's something that, for example, Ford Coppola's interpretation of the book is quite masterful in some ways, and it's entertaining, and you can sit down and watch it, and you can say, yeah, I was entertained by that. That was fun. That was pretty cool. Love the costume design. Love the sets. But then if you look at Dracula 3000, if you've ever had the misfortune of seeing that film, or some of the, you know, the other, like, really, really terrible knockoff Draculas, I get aggrieved at that, but I generally get aggrieved at poor storytelling. I think that's what annoys me the most. You have a literary classic, a piece of text that you can extrapolate from, and then you end up with something that's particularly terrible. I'm aggrieved at that, actually. I think that actually damages the original novel. But if it's just if you're talking about a different interpretation, but it's done well, sure, why not? That's fun.
Well, we've got the filmmakers of Dracula 3000 here. No.
Way to go, Chris.
The line. Yeah, so they're on the other line. So let's talk. No, I understand. I mean, it's just when they take something that's a creation like Dracula and just putting really poor writing or poor effort into it and making it come out not that good, it's irritating.
Alan, here's an example, a very recent one, and I'll throw this out to all of you guys on the show here. Recently, The Last Voyage of the Demeter came out. Didn't last very long in the cinemas. I thought it was excellent. It was really close to Bram's Chapter 7, which we're only left with the ship's log. Obviously, we know the ending already, and I thought it was pretty true. There's lots of jump scares. It was a good, scary, kind of claustrophobic film, very close to what Bram wrote. And yet, it didn't hit a home run in the opening weekend, which seems to be the way many films are judged. It was on the heels of Barbie and Oppenheimer, which, you know, just blew up everybody. You know, everybody hadn't gone to a theater for years, spent all their monies on it. And yet, that one is now released, Demeter, in streaming. And yet, I thought it was really close. The film that came out a few months earlier, Renfield, with Nicolas Cage, was a complete reimagination of The character Renfield is a mental health person. Nicolas Cage did a great job, but it was a comic horror. Nothing like Dracula, but it was, you know, somewhat of a success because for some reason people like Nick Cage and a comic horror. Not my cup of tea. I much prefer the dark Voyage of the Demeter, but that just shows that, you know, everybody has their own taste and to each his own. I don't know what you guys thought about those two or if you'd seen them, but that's a perfect example of the way reimagining and things have changed and not always everybody's cup of tea.
Yeah, well, I watched. I think I got through about 5 minutes of Cage's version, and I just, you know, I just was bored. I just kind of, I don't know why. I think Dave liked it better, but...
I did.
Yeah, but I
did, but I haven't seen the newest one, the Last Voyage.
Well, that brings me, like, Chris, so when you are taking all of these characters and you're bringing these characters back into the Stokerverse, like Frankenstein and Jekyll and Hyde and stuff like that, how close to what Bram had done with them or written them are you keeping it?
So this is the interesting sort of thing about the Stokerverse, because it is a true verse. So for the RPG that's come out, and you know, it's a massive success. It's a, you know, bestseller now in RPG terms. It's sold out across all the gaming expos that it's been to. We started to introduce characters such as, you know, the Frankenstein's monster, Jekyll and Hyde, Miss Havisham from Dickens, Sherlock Holmes, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But what we wanted to do was look at the characters as if Bram Stoker had created them. So for Miss Havisham, for example, we turned her into a zombie, a member of the undead. She's perpetually waiting for her husband. She's covered in cobwebs. She's waiting for her husband, you know. And I thought that was a great sort of twist that she's actually a member of the undead. But that perpetually waiting part of it, I thought Bram would really have gravitated towards. Frankenstein's creature is an artist in East End of London. That's what's happened to him. And I saw this very clearly that because Bram was a painter, he sketched, he painted, and I could see Frankenstein's creature being taken in by this artist lady into a upstairs lodging place above a public house, and she gives Frankenstein's creature paints. Now, Shelley's Frankenstein's creature is quite articulate, quite verbose. This would be that he's articulate, but he cannot fully express his emotions. So he uses paint. And what the artist lady notices is that Frankenstein's creature uses one colour on the canvas. And she teaches him to use many colours. And that is obviously to show him that life can be experienced through many different emotions. She is tragically run down by a carriage. Frankenstein's creature carries on her legacy of painting and artwork. And the citizens of the East End of London leave him food because he's actually become the protector of the poor and the impoverished of that era. So that's two examples of how I think Bram would have recrafted, or if he had created those characters, how he'd have created those characters. Jekyll and Hyde's an interesting one as well, because we've got the classic conflict between good and evil, which Bram was obsessed about. A lot of Bram's work is linked to that. Why does evil exist in a world that was created by a good and benevolent God? Because Bram's work is very theological. It's very theological. And, you know, Jekyll and Hyde, Jekyll's been promised that he wants to get rid of all the evil in him. And what person wouldn't want to get rid of their shadow, get rid of all the evil? But as we know, through studies of Freud and Jung, you must always try and integrate your shadow self. Jekyll can't integrate his shadow self because it's too dark, it consumes him. So whenever he takes the potion and then transforms into Hyde, it just gets too much for him. Now he jumps out the window to try and kill himself. Halfway through, he transforms into Hyde, and as he hits the ground, they're fused together as one, and they survive. So now Jekyll's in this hell that he has to now live with his shadow self. And the two of them are constantly talking and bickering and at different odds with each other. they're truly a split personality, but they've become one unit, almost like Two-Face from Batman in a way.
Welcome to my life.
But that's how I sort of looked at how I think Bram would have taken the psychological dynamics, the theological dynamics, and the personal dynamics of those characters, and reshaped them sort of into that. And you see more of this in issue two, because we've got all those characters in issue two as well, in a couple of text-based stories, and a little side strip as well.
Yeah, and I know that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, I guess he was friends with Bram, and I know we're talking to a historian, actually tomorrow's interview is Neil Story from the UK, and so they were friends, and of course now you're also bringing in Sherlock Holmes into the Stokerverse. So how is that going to work?
Well, let me just start by saying you got a great guy, Neil Story, who has done a nice biography, good work on Bram's biography. And I don't often say that because some of the biographies I don't like, but Neil has consulted me from the beginning, a couple things that I helped him reimagine. I'm so glad you're talking to him. I can't wait to listen to that show.
Well, I love him. He's such a good guy.
He's a great guy. But, you know, Bram and Conan Doyle were actually very close friends. Bram did an article about his life as he's about to get ready for his wedding. That drew them close. Bram and Florence were invited to his wedding. But closer still, I think as authors, they hit it off together. Conan Doyle, with Bram's help, got one of his short stories into a play on the Lyceum Theater. But there was also a letter that Conan Doyle wrote Bram, congratulating him on Dracula, and it touched upon sort of the whole idea of the occult. There's this one sentence in there that I often mention in my lectures, and Chris and I kind of use it, you know, from time to time, where he says, you know, the story is the best story of diablerie that I have read for a long time. And it takes a one to know one, you know, an occultist like Conan Doyle was, to understand that and recognize that the occult is at play in this story. And that makes it easy for Chris and I. And it's, you know, it's a tip of a hat to both Bram and Conan Doyle's relationship, to then integrate Conan Doyle's greatest creation, Sherlock Holmes. So Chris, I've teed it up nicely for you to take it from there on what we do with Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah. Yeah. So the whole thing with Conan Doyle and Bram Stoker is that they were both Freemasons. And so am I. And there's a lot of that, as Decker was saying, occult in the two authors' writings. So I thought it would be a great homage to their friendship to bring Sherlock Holmes into the Stokerverse. And obviously we've altered him slightly, but he's there, he's present. And, we used him in the RPG because there's a fun adventure that you can play with Holmes, and set against sort of the backdrop of murders happening in London, which initially the players believe is Jack the Ripper, but it's not. It's one of Dracula's creatures. And Holmes has encountered supernatural before. So if you remember the Holmesian story, The Sussex Vampire, well, in the Stokerverse version, it actually was a vampire. It wasn't just a little boy that kind of was aggrieved at his younger brother. It was actually a vampire in our version. So we've sort of changed slight moments of Holmes' backstory so that now he can accept the supernatural as logical.
You know, with these characters, what do you think, like, as a general thought, like you take Sherlock Holmes, for instance, or you take Dracula, what is it about certain characters, even if they're fictional, that stay with the world for 100 years or even longer, and there's tons of duplications and rewriting and repeating of the same? People go to find Sherlock Holmes' home, they'll go to England, you know, like there's all this stuff. What makes them stay generation after generation? What are you guys' thought?
Well, Chris, I'll jump first to Dracula here. One of the things I've thought about, what gives such endurance, is that as a character in the novel Dracula, he's not all that well known. He's not fleshed out in the sense that authors would go to great detail and letting the readers totally understand where he comes from, what his background, what motivates him. Dracula is Count Dracula is certainly a mystery, and he remains a mystery throughout the novel. We know of Count Dracula mostly from what the characters who are trying to banish him, first avoid him and banish him and destroy him. We know of him through their minds. We don't know Count Dracula himself. And Bram was masterful that way because he's left that great kind of cliffhanger question mark. Who he really is? Where did he really come from? What motivates him other than, you know, drinking blood and staying alive, staying immortal? So that has resulted in, at the moment, 127 years of writers and screenwriters, playwrights, of integrating their thoughts, their ideas into who this Dracula could have been without too much, a diversion from what Bram set up. So if you set up a character and then somebody made him completely different, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, there would be some obvious, you know, fans that would get upset. Now, I have got a little upset when the vampires in Twilight sparkle in the day in their little teeny boppers, but they're not Dracula. So I can live with that, but they do take the vampire genre and turn it upside down. Got a lot of people in the theaters, and Stephanie Meyer sold a lot of books, and that's okay. But that's why I think that the Count Dracula that Chris and I use, the back to Bram's Dracula, you know, we didn't have to go too far, even though people have taken a different direction. They still recognize that original, you know, revenant from the grave. And that's where he started. That's what we recognized, even though he's been able to take on many different variations in 127 years.
Okay. And now, Chris, did you have an add to that or no?
I think it's depth and resonance. I think that's the, you know, for all the sort of the characters like Doctor Who or Sherlock Holmes or Dracula, or, you know, I particularly like Van Helsing myself. I say a big fan of Van Helsing. That resonance that characters have because they speak to more than what we read on the surface. And I think that's very powerful. I look at modern entertainment, and the reason I started all of this, I started this journey, was because modern entertainment failed me and continues to fail me. There's no depth or resonance to about 90% of it all. With Sherlock Holmes, there's a resonance because he's a dependable guy who can solve mysteries, but beyond that, he's somebody who's deeply committed to his art form. In studying Scarlet, you know, Watson draws up a list of what Holmes knows and what he doesn't know. He doesn't know much about literature or astronomy, but he knows about poisons and horticulture because he's committed to the art and craft. He's also somebody who's honourable. He has good intentions. And he's reliable and trustworthy. And he's also mysterious. So all of that sort of the depth and resonance of the character would make him somebody you want to know. And I'm talking about Arthur Conan Doyle's Holmes. I'm not talking about the modern interpretation of Holmes that has him as sort of a slightly cold, sociopathic, psychopathic, one-dimensional character. And you can draw conclusions from that. What TV show I'm talking about there. But it really, really bugs me. And I think that's why, if you look at Dracula, Dracula's exceptionally evil. He's malevolent. He's violent. He's vicious. But he's also intelligent. He's got animal cunning. He can manipulate people through words. He doesn't necessarily have to use hypnosis. He can manipulate you through words. And he's the devil. He's absolutely the devil. He whispers in your ear, what do you want? What would you like? And then he sets people on the worst path in order for them to get what they want. So apart from his supernatural abilities, he's got that almost, there's a beautiful painting, and I can't remember who painted it, but it's the Antichrist. So he looks like Christ, but he's got horns, and he whispers in the ear of people. I think of a politician. And it's that Antichrist figure, very, very powerful Antichrist figure. Again, resonant, the manipulation resonant. We may not like what Dracula does or who he is, And I think that's why he's a powerfully attractive character to read and find out more about.
So, Alan, I'm just going to say this, you know, to recognize these are the two most often adapted literary characters into film. Sherlock Holmes first, Count Dracula second. And they've both, you know, gone on, you know, pretty much, you know, over 100 and a quarter century. So it stands to reason, even though I'm not a film writer or a playwright, that in all that time, creative people want to put their own mark, their own spin on these two characters. And so, again, I can only imagine that, you know, a producer wants to make a Dracula film or Sherlock Holmes film, and they get a bunch of writers to give their pitch and to write their beginnings of a screenplay or write a pilot. And they say, well, what's different about this? It's always what's new and what's different. It's not, oh, can you make the same one that is exactly the same as Bram Stoker could? Nobody's done that. So the industry seems to place people, the writers, the creatives, on a path to change them just because that's, you know, people want to say, oh, that's an interesting take. That guy's really, what a great writer. He's added this to it. So I think there is, and it's something that Chris and I try to balance. You want to do a little originality here so you're not just the same old, but you do need to stay true to the original. But you want to add a little something interesting so that you will stand out as a writer saying, we're just not rehashing stuff. That's where some people, I think, and as you've heard Chris say, go too far and don't suit us that much. But, you know, that's the way of the world when it comes to creatives and entertainment.
Right.
Well, you know, speaking of Holmes and the devil, right, when I think of vampires, for some reason I think of, like, guardian dogs, hounds of hell. Will the hounds of hell, or have they... Well, I should say the Hounds of the Baskervilles from the Holmes story. Will they make an appearance, or have they?
Well, come, you know, in Dracula, the big black dog in Yorkshire certainly did. Wasn't highly, you know, sensationalized. And I don't think, Chris, you may know better, because, you know, one of the books we're working on that you're doing the lion's share of is cinematic history of Dracula films. But the...
Yeah, every vampire film ever made.
Yeah, but Chris, have you noticed the black dog, the Bagasht in Yorkshire, when the Demeter, in the book now, when
yes.
the Demeter comes crashes into the shore, Dracula does not leave the ship as a wolf or as a bat,
yeah.
or as Count Dracula in a human form. He jumps off as a big black dog, runs up the 199 steps, seeks refuge in a grave of a suicide, and we learn later on, people that are in the know, that is the myth of the big black dog of Yorkshire, which is very close to, you know, the Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that there's a real animal and predator motif in Dracula as well. So it's kind of one of the most ominous powers that Dracula has, and a lot of people don't delve into it, but it's that ability to manipulate animals and then be able to transform into them as well. So that kind of adds to the savagery and suspense of the novel, and then it just highlights that Dracula's position as the ultimate predator. And you get this, like Bram repeatedly references animals in strange ways with their service to Dracula. You know, you've got the whole thing that, you know, the bat and the dog being able to command animals with the wolves. And then you've got, you know, even like Renfield eating insects and larger animals. There's a recurring sort of theme in animals within the events of Dracula. So I find that fascinating. The book that we're talking about, and we've signed the contract, so I think we can talk about it. It's from Tell Us Publishers. It's the entire cinematic history of vampire films from the late 1800s. Right the way through to modern times, and that is a labour of love, I can tell you. But when you research it, when you research all the films, you can just see that, you know, how powerful the Dracula story has been and how influential in every single vampire film. Even like modern classics like Near Dark, there's powerful motifs in there. So Decker and I are sort of, we're reviewing the films, we're exploring the films, but we're also then injecting a little bit about, you know, for example, Nosferatu and the issues with Nosferatu and Dracula and all sort of aspects of that. So we are beavering away on that, and it is coming out. I've been told the deadline is in the next couple of months, because it's definitely coming out next year. So there you go. You've heard it first.
There we go. The reveal.
Yeah.
I mean, speaking of reveals here, you talk about revealing who may have been the real Dracula in the comic book. And you mentioned Henry Irving and not Vlad and stuff like that. And that's going to be in a side strip. So explain that and explain a side strip for people.
Well, Chris, you tell them a side strip and I'll give a little bit of my version of that merge character. So you go with the side strip first.
Right. So a side strip is essentially a smaller comic book narrative that's within a graphic novel. So, for example, our main Dracula story is generally about 22 pages, 22 to 25 pages. So a side strip can be, you know, from 5 pages to 10 pages. So it's usually very quickly told narrative. Side strips they have to be very powerful, because they have to pack a punch from the first 3 panels. It's one of the art forms of trying to tell a comic book narrative is the shorter page volume, but you can do so much in even 5 pages. So what we're doing is we are in one of the side strips in issue 2, we are going to start to delve into this a little bit more. What was the connection between Henry Irving and Dracula? And I'm going to let Decker take over now.
So yeah, just before I do, it's a side script is usually it contributes to the story, but it's sort of like bonus material. You know, you're reading the story and you go off the side script near the end or wherever it's put, and it's like, oh yeah, that gives you a little bit extra. But yeah, let's get back to this, because Bram was influenced by many things in his life, but he used them. He wove them into the fabric of the story. These influences in his life, people, places, and events that really happen. And quite often what he did was he had merged those things together, changed them up just a little bit, so that you weren't exactly sure, other than places like Whitby, which was named Whitby in the book, and the Demeter crashed there. Well, it was actually the Dimitri that really crashed there under very similar circumstances. And he did a little subtle changes with the storm and so on that he got records of to bring the Demeter in. Well, probably the most complex issue that has been argued about over the years has been, who is his inspiration and his model been for Count Dracula? And we know he did a lot of research into the contemporary at the time, the vampire myths, both in America, in the medieval days. We know the books that he looked at, and it was all of these, you know, creatures or spirits coming out of the graves and all that. But he also looked into the history of Vlad Dracula, Vlad the Impaler, Vlad Dracula III, the Prince of Wallachia right next door to Transylvania, who happened to have a very interesting and bloodthirsty backstory. He was also referred to as the devil in 2 of the books that Bram looked at for his research that was in the London Library. But that's only one piece of him. Vlad Dracula was not a vampire. He was not a blood drinker I wouldn't say by any stretch of the imagination. He was bloodthirsty and did some horrific things to people. But the actual persona, the description of his Count Dracula, bore an incredible connection to his boss, Sir Henry Irving, who was a very dominating person and I believe really treated Bram much like a Jonathan Harker type, this sort of subservient person that came over to consummate the real estate transactions, the guy that was having to do all the paperwork for the count. Bram did the same thing for 27 years for Irving. Always was in his shadows, always was in the background, but quite happy to be there. Wouldn't say the same for Harker, but nonetheless, this is an element of the relationship that Bram garnered from himself, the Henry Irving and Bram Stoker relationship, but also the fact of his physical appearance and the way he described him was Henry Irving playing the role of Mephistopheles, that devil in the play Faust. And he saw that it was the second most popular stage play that Irving did during Bram's time with him. So you've got the real Henry Irving, the nocturnal sort of lifestyle of the theater. Irving and Stoker traveling all over the place together, their adventures they went on, very similar to that nocturnal sort of lifestyle of the Count in Castle Dracula, the Count traveling by ship to come to England, all the boxes, very similar to Bram having to arrange all the boxes of the sets of the Lyceum Theater, going over to America and back 8 times. So he took all these similarities, the devil in Faust, Henry Irving, Vlad the Impaler, and put them all together. And so since so many people have already connected him, mostly in film, to Vlad the Impaler, Chris and I said, well, the next logical thing to do is dangle Henry Irving out there. Let's let people know that he was a major component of this famous Count Dracula. And that's why we've come up with this extra strip to explain some of their relationship and how that relationship in real life could have transferred over into Bram Stoker using him as his inspiration for Count Dracula. Chris, did I leave anything out?
No, that's spot on. Exactly spot on. And for eagle-eyed readers, they'll see the side strip actually links into our main strip as well. But I'm not going to spoil that.
Actually, so when we talk about this, the artwork, who was behind the artwork in this comic book?
So we have our main artist is a chap called Chris Geary. So he's returning from issue one. We have an amazing colourist called Matt Soff, and Matt works extensively in the UK comic book industry, most notably with 2000 AD. If you pick up a copy of 2000 AD this week, you'll see his colours in the latest Judge Dredd. Our side strips are being illustrated by the prolific and extremely talented David Hitchcock, and his work's incredible. It's very gothic, it's very detailed, and he always slips in little hidden things into the artwork. So whenever you look back on it 2 or 3 times, you start to see different things in there, which I love. So those are our main artists, and then we have alternative cover artists, but I'm not allowed to talk about them too much. But they're stars within the comic book industry.
You could tell us, but you'd have to kill us.
It would be ugly. It would be ugly. Yeah. A lot of bloodshed.
Yeah, it would be real messy. Well, and how did the first one do? Are you happy with the way the first one turned out and how the sales went through? And what do you expect for the next one?
Do you want me to take that one, Taker?
Yeah, because quite honestly, I guess from the standpoint, I couldn't tell you numbers, but I never can. I don't know.
We haven't actually got the numbers yet, but basically we're selling out everywhere we go. So every convention we've been selling out with our publisher. Our publisher has put on the Zoot page that it's massively successful, and he's told me the same thing. We were picked up by Diamond Distribution to go out into North America, and generally that only happens with the more popular titles. So we've done very well with the comic.
I tell you, everywhere I take my stack and go to my conventions, I sell out, and I say, "God, I should have bought more," because it's that the artwork is so cool, the story concept is so cool, that the extra strips are neat, and I'm really looking forward to this. We did this first one on Zoop. We're going to do another one on Zoop. They're going to take care of the fulfillment of this, which hopefully will make it much easier for people to, when they pledge for it, to get their copies later on. We had a few hiccups at the beginning when there was a strike in England and one of the distributors lost a massive box of books coming to North America. So that didn't look good. But, things like that happen. But we think we've recovered from that. Our publisher, Shane Chesby, with Scratch Comics, has assured us that it's not going to happen. Zoop is going to take care of everything. So I think we're just going to build on the success. And hopefully Chris and I will get numbers at some point so we can tout them properly. But you know, I get great feedback anywhere I go with it. So I'm real proud of it myself as well.
We wouldn't be going to issue two if issue one hadn't worked.
Exactly.
It's pretty much, it's as simple as that, because, and the comic book industry, as you guys know, it's tough. It's very, very tough visibility, and it's tough to get out there. The fact that we've got, you know, into every major convention, including London Film and Comic Con this year, we're going to be at Thought Bubble, which is the UK's premier. It's kind of the elite convention for comic books. We're there next month, I believe. And we're all across North America with plans to go into Europe as well. So, I mean, that's pretty respectable. I'm very proud of that.
Yeah. And so where do people get the book, the comic book, and where do they find you guys? Or do they, like, any other conventions or shows you're going to, and websites? Or give us all the information of finding the two, you two.
Well, Chris, I think this is going to be the first time we're going to be able to drop the Stokerverse website. Come on, man. Do it. Do the honors.
Right, okay. I'll do it. It's www.stokerverse.com, and you'll be able to go there. You'll see all our products, all our games, all our comic books, including, you know, Dracula Return, Cult of the White Worm. You can read up on what Decker's written as well, Decker's bibliography, and all the bits and pieces that I've been doing, Doctor Who stuff and science fiction stuff and audios and things as well. So it's a one-stop shop for the Stokerverse. If you want to grab the comics from scratch, and you can actually see some of the images of the artwork for issue one on Scratch Comics, it's www.scratchcomics.co.uk. If you Google Dracula the Return, Cult of the White Worm, you will find that it's stocked in some local comic book shops across the states, including New York, Washington, Massachusetts, I've been told, and you'll find online North American retailers as well.
Chris, what is the big one in England?
Forbidden Planet.
That's it.
Absolutely, yeah. Correct. We are in, yeah, Forbidden Planet. We're in Forbidden Planet. Stokerverse is in Forbidden Planet twice, because we've got our Stokerverse RPG from Nightfall Games, which is a beautiful hardbacked, over 300 pages, RPG book, which is also an encyclopedia of the Stokerverse. You don't just get the RPG game, but you get all the facts and characters and all sort of information of characters, and also some stories. We actually have a Stokerverse RPG storybook, which contains 60 pages of story content, exclusive story content from Decker and myself. We have some story content as well in the RPG. And it's in Forbidden Planet, along with our Dracula Return issue one.
And are we able to publicize where people can get that really cool board game with the figures from Crooked Dice?
Oh, yeah, it is. You're completely correct. It's www.crookeddice.co.uk. And if you go there, you'll be able to go and look at the products list, and you will see the Stokerverse 7TV Dracula series of products.
And then, since I'm a Montreal boy originally, and I'm saying that as a hint, are we allowed to talk about that product coming from that side of Canada?
The dark side of Canada?
No, we can't. We can talk about... Yes, you know what? I know the one you're talking about. This is a bit cryptic. Yes, we can talk about the video game. Like the video
game. Okay, that's what I thought. I didn't know if we're allowed to
not
say that.
Not the other one. Not the other thing. No. We have another thing coming from Canada. Another that's not... it's very exciting. God, I think it's actually could potentially be the biggest product we've done yet, but we can talk about the video game. So we've got an upcoming video game called Dracula Dark Reign, and it's being created by Spacebot Interactive. It's 75% complete, and if you go to the website now,
that's Incubate.
It's Incubate. It is Incubate. So you can go to www.incubate.com. So it's incubate.com.
And the number 8. The numeral 8. Yeah.
Yep.
Incubate 8 number. Yeah. It's some incredible cool stuff. It's out there, as Chris mentioned, a new website. Chris and I are very active on Facebook. We've got a Dracula Return Facebook page. We both have our own pages. We got a Stokerverse page. And if you want more on Bram Stoker and the family, my wife and I actually run BramStokerEstate.com, where we give lots of information about all the members of the family, even the ones that Chris and I have used from the family, Bram's other brothers, George Thornley, and some others will be making appearances as well.
Well, fantastic. Of course, we'll have all of that up on the website. People can find it easily. And we really appreciate you coming by and, you know, taking time away from fishing there, Dacker. That's right.
Well, the last time we talked, I was fishing in Fernie,
yeah.
One of my favorite places, and I keep coming back. And, you know, that's, you know, what I try to do to just clear the head. The rest of the time, it's nicely full of Dracula, Bram Stoker, and all things Stokerverse. Not a bad place to be for the month of October.
No, Fernie's a good place, you know. And well, I just think you could do a new Dracula, Canadian Dracula, that said sorry all the time.
A polite Dracula, yeah?
Dracula, eh? Sorry. Oh, I'm terrible. Anyway, well, we appreciate you being here. So we have Chris McCauley and Dacre Stoker. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.